This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich here again, as usual, with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
And joining us today is a first-time Little Gold Men guest. I have stopped saying everyone's titles because I got sick of saying it. But Jeff Giles, we have to introduce you because no one knows you yet. Jeff Giles, you are Vanity Fair's executive Hollywood editor. I'm even going to get
That's
your title wrong.
Perfectly fine. Thank you. Yes, that is right.
Jeff, you're joining us for the first time, kind of unbelievably, but on such an auspicious day, because today as we record this, we have launched the Hollywood issue, my favorite issue of the year, obviously, maybe all of our favorite issues of the year. This year's is so spectacular, and we talk about it every year on the show, but I figured you were, you know, instrumental along with a lot of other people making this happen. So before we get into the rest of the show, which I should set up briefly, we're going to talk about Cherry and the United States versus Billie Holiday. We're going to preview the Golden Globes. And we're going to have Joanna's interview with Mads Mikkelsen, the star of Another Round. But first, Jeff, how did this beautiful, colorful, bright and shiny Hollywood issue come together? And what's your favorite part of it? What do you love the most?
I love Richard's cover story the most, obviously. and that's all I will say.
Yeah.
No, I love it all, obviously. It started with, you know, how do we do a great big production in a pandemic? Is it even possible? And our creative director, Kira Pollack, had a great idea to reach out to these two artists, Maurizio Catalan and Pier Paolo Ferrari, who are in Milan, I believe. And because they do a lot of collage work, because they have a surreal, whimsical kind of touch, it brought a level of art to it that was fantastic and we'd never really done before. And it allowed us to shoot on 5 different continents at all kinds of different times and to be playful with something that, you know, at a time of lockdown would absolutely not have been possible and would have looked really fake and awful. So that was a huge win from the beginning when we realized, when we got them on board, the artists, and we saw the kind of vision that they had for it. And then, and this is something Richard talks about really beautifully in his cover story, which I'm now plugging for the second time.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be Venmoing you, Jeff. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. When I see the notification, I will keep going. The idea was to pick people that have kind of lit the way for us in this awful time. Last year, obviously, wasn't just a pandemic. It was a horrific political landscape, a horrific social and racial injustice landscape. And, you know, one of the things we talked a lot about is how do we express some hope after, you know, we were putting this out before the Trumps had left the White House, so it wasn't even as hopeful as it is now. But so that was part of it. We wanted to pick people that had really off screen and on screen showed a lot of hope in humanity, basically. And then it was, you know, these are our favorite beloved people of all kinds.
Yeah, Richard, you had what I think is kind of the unenviable task of like taking what feels like a really like intuitive group of people being like, these are all people we're excited about. They're people who are moving the cultural conversation, and then writing into a story that I don't think I would have been able to handle that assignment very well. But so, and you had the quotes, you know, a lot of us talked to the people who were on the cover and you kind of had their quotes to put in. But how did you approach writing the story that really synthesized all of this?
Well, I think you just have to kind of get at the why, like why these people. And not everyone is going to fit one neat rubric, but I think the general sense was that across all platforms, genres, styles, whatever, everyone on the cover has been doing work that feels entertaining and exciting, but also has an extra dimension of commentary or some sort of reactive energy to what's been going on in the country, around the world for the past, you know, however many years. And, you know, that comes in the form of an action movie like Charlize Theron in The Old Guard or Dan Levy in Schitt's Creek, or sort of more like directly activist work like Lakeith Stanfield in Judas and the Black Messiah, or Maya Rudolph kind of, you know, helping shape a sort of comedy around a very scary election with playing Kamala Harris on SNL. Like, you know, it's just basically just trying to talk about the fact that like art comes in many forms, many styles, many tones, comedic, dramatic, whatever. But like right now, it's really nice to have that extra dimension of meaning behind it. And all those people on the cover have done that.
Somebody made a great point that I, while we were making the thing, that I then stole to write into some headline stuff, which is that a lot of these people, their career paths were so interesting because they didn't sit around waiting to be invited in. You know, they wrote stuff, they acted in their own stuff. They were creators as well. And even the younger ones knew from the beginning that they'd be better served if they did it themselves. And I think, you know, Spike Lee has been around a long time and obviously did everything himself for a very long time. But you see it now with like Dan Levy and Michaela Cole and a lot of other people. Just about everybody who's on that list. They're very unconventional paths because that you can't sit around waiting for the gatekeepers to let you in.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I was so excited about Charlize. I mean, there's so many people on this that I'm excited about, but I loved The Old Guard and I loved the way that she used her, you know, decades of star power to get this movie made, in which she is the star, but it's like a very visual handing the torch over to another generation and all these people who were not able to lead their own action movies beforehand. And I was excited to see that represented on this cover too.
I remember when we did our we did the first look on The Old Guard, and when people just first saw those photographs, they went nuts for them. And I was reminded, like, how many different constituencies she has and fan bases. And there's not many people like that. And she's just so, you know, you read her Q&A on the site today. She's really just badass, to use a overused word.
I'm going back. I think she has the longest history on the Hollywood cover. I'm, you know, obsessed with the history of the Hollywood issue covers. Many
people
are. Oh,
yeah. Tell us some trivia.
She was on the 1997 cover, which is kind of mind-boggling. She was on the third panel, you know, with Jennifer Lopez. So they turned out okay for having been stars at that point. And I haven't gone back and looked. I imagine that is the earliest appearance. I know Zendaya has been on a previous cover. Michael B. Jordan has. Everyone else might be first timers, honestly. I'd have to go back and look.
It's just so, like, we bring up the history and it's so fun to look at this cover. I loved all the Hollywood covers that we've done in my tenure here, but I feel like there used to be this kind of like almost mathematical equation we used to do. And there used to be like, you know, it used to feel very like calculated. And this just feels so fun and energetic and bright and optimistic and hopeful and future looking. And I just love the energy of this and how it really just breaks out of that model that we ran for so long, you know?
And anyone in particular you love seeing, Joanna?
I'm always happy to see Zendaya anywhere.
And that dress, my God.
Yeah. And the interior photo of her, like, with the boulder and the gorgeous dress is just, it's incredible.
There is a history of having, like, one person pop in red on the cover. Like, in 2018, Jessica Chastain is wearing red. In 2017, Naomi Harris is, like, got this bright pink gown. So I like that continuing, even though this is not a very traditional cover, that some things stay the same.
Yeah. Radhika Jones, you know, our boss, just absolutely wants to reinvent this every year so that it isn't, like Joanna saying, a mathematical equation. So it speaks to the year. And that's hard every time. It's easy. I mean, not that the covers they did for 25 years were easy because they're magnificent. But, you know, rethinking it every year and how do you do something that looks visually very different, especially in a pandemic? You know, we could have done, we could have utterly faked a group shot and pretended that they were all in the same room. But that seemed pointless. People are too smart for that. And like Joanna said, I think it speaks to the moment a lot better.
I think it would have made people actively uncomfortable if they thought that these people were all in the same room. Like, you, when you watch old movies and see people in a restaurant, you're like, no, get out of there. Like, you can't do that.
I get a kick out of all the different ways people have done photography in the pandemic. I mean, maybe getting a kick out of it's the wrong thing to say, but like, you know, drones and shooting through windows and like, it's just, it's an interesting, it's just the creativity that's come out of this has been kind of phenomenal. And, you know, these guys, I think the artists, Catalan and Ferrari, were in Costa Rica when all this happened. And like I said, you know, we were shooting in Ghana and like England and America, and every shoot was a full-blown cover shoot, and they were able to like air traffic control it all. It's was kind of amazing to behold.
Yeah, I always marvel at the fashion team managing to find stuff for these people to wear and get them shipped all over the place. You know, in the old days, you would just be sending like 30 crates to the one studio in LA where the whole thing was taking place. And the logistics of this are kind of their entire own saga.
And I think the stars were excited to do something different. And first, when they heard the artist, a lot of them were aware of Catalan's work. And, you know, these are the guys that duct taped a banana to the wall at the Art Basel gallery a few years ago. They're playful. They do all kinds of different work. And I think that got the talent really excited. And you know, because you're explaining stuff like to Charlize, Britt Hanemuth, our colleague, would have to, I think, explain this stuff. Like, Charlize, you're going to be boxing a bear, you know? And I didn't hear all those discussions. But I have a feeling like when you tell Lakeith Stansfield he's on a horse, that's more fun than saying, okay, you know, you're going to be wearing a tux and you're going to be holding a cocktail.
Yeah. Or like Spike Lee riding on top of one of the gargoyles on the Chrysler Building, or eagles. What are those things?
I love that. We weren't sure how into it all Spike would be, and he was obviously fantastic.
Yeah. Should we talk about what's inside the issue? Anything you guys are especially – I haven't even read the whole thing yet, but what should people be looking out for?
I don't know if we've talked about it a little bit on this podcast, but Amanda Seyfried gave this great performance in Make This
Who
Year.
Wrote that?
Oh, there's this piece by Katie Rich that's on our website, vanityfair.com.
Real up and comer.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, with some beautiful photos. So that's what I would immediately
Katie's piece is great.
I mean, start with Richard's cover story, roll on to Katie Rich, you know, for the...
Then you got to read the Snyder Cut, right?
It's
like
true.
Anthony, a frequent guest on this show, wrote this really tremendous story about a very complicated topic with Zack Snyder and the Snyder Cut. That it's online now, so you can read it now.
You know what? There's a couple of things I especially love that I'll shout out, and there's just so much online right now that it's going to take people a while to find everything. Jenny Lumet, who's a TV writer creator, she's doing Clarice right now, but you know, she wrote Rachel Getting Married, and obviously she's Sidney Lumet's daughter, Lena Horne's granddaughter. But she wrote a column I love called "We'll Woke Go Up in Smoke" that's sort of about what happens to people's virtue signaling when they feel like the pressure's off because the Nazis are out of the White House. I love that piece. It's the weirdest, maybe most R-rated thing I've edited that I can remember. And I remember when it came in, I was like, wow, I don't know if we'll publish this. But, you know, and Radhika just loved it, which as I did. So I love that. There's a kind of great director's portfolio, because I think it's been a great – Richard can speak to this better than me, but it's been a good year for directors of all kinds. And so we have a beautiful photography portfolio of directors who are either like literally just starting or just really being noticed for the first time. And that, you know, Regina King obviously is incredibly famous as an actor, but has her first directorial feature. So she's in there, Radha Blank, who did 40-Year-Old Virgin, and Lee Isaac Chung, who made Minari, and obviously Emerald Fennell, who made Promising Young Woman. I love that portfolio, and it's part of a – online you'll find 10 directors who represent like all kinds of great and weird movies.
Richard, anything you want to shout out?
Yeah, my former Gawker coworker, Maureen O'Connor, wrote a piece about Dumois, the Instagram gossip repository.
Yeah.
That's a really fascinating, as Maureen often does, like – explanation for us a little bit more out of touch about like what this kind of new thing is, but also has a lot of sort of insidery knowledge too. It's not just for me who doesn't understand these things.
Yeah.
So that's a really fun piece that I, you know, and I like that it's adding this other dimension to a Hollywood Issues coverage. It's not just about the talent. It's also about the industry and the ancillary industries around that industry, you know, in a really cool kind of synthesis of like tech and celebrity and all that stuff.
I was going to say a similar thing about the Hillsong piece that Dan Adler, who I work with in the Vanity section, wrote along with Alex French. You know, Carl Lentz was not a Hollywood person, but had a lot of Hollywood connections, and that church's downfall is really tied in with its celebrity status. So another way to kind of expand the mandate.
Yeah, and these stories, that I mean, Matt Lynch edited three of the juicier stories in the magazine, Hillsong Dumois and the Hollywood con artist who kind of defrauded all these below-the-line workers those stories were evolving as we were reporting them, and you know, we put them online early because we had really fresh news in them that we wanted to get out there. But it was a perfect example of like keeping them as current as you possibly can to the last second, and giving people, both who had been following the story really carefully, like what's the absolute latest with Hillsong, but also if you had never read a word about Hillsong, you could get everything you needed from there.
Yeah. I don't know. We've been here and praising our own work for so long. Is there anything else we want to throw out there? Or
maybe just praise each other more. I don't know.
I will say that on the, if you go to vanityfair.com, I guess maybe by the time you don't hear this, but if you go to the landing page for it, there's a lot of articles from our awards extra issue included in there, including a piece from Joanna about Wolf Walkers, which I love and edited, and about the costumes. So I like seeing these things kind of put hand in hand, since the awards issue is kind of a whole other separate endeavor. But so many of these stories really go together, and I love seeing them all online together.
Yeah, it's really fun to scroll down and you get like Johanna's great Chadwick Boseman pieces there. You know, there's just like, it is fun to sort of blur that line on the landing page of the website. It all looks gorgeous. The design on the website today is amazing. So
the hardest thing for me was knowing we were going to come out so many months later. And this, as Richard writes about in his excellent Frontrunners piece in the on the website, this was a weird Oscar race. And 3 or 4 months ago, even today, we know a lot more, I think, about what will happen with the nominations. But 3 or 4 months ago, it was really guesswork. A lot of the things hadn't been seen. And so to be able to rely on you guys to be right about stuff so far ahead of time was a gift, I have to say, because when we open these issues and look at this stuff now, like I had never heard of that Irish animated movie Joanna was talking about. And I was just like, okay, Joanna's usually right. Let's do it. And that's great, because it's never been weirder that I can remember, never been harder to predict what will happen. Because, you know, the lines between TV and movies are so weird. The fact that you didn't know what movie was going to spark and not spark. I remember seeing a movie, I won't say its title because it's quite bad, but, you know, the platform that was very excited about it said, we're showing you this movie and it's going to take over the Oscar race. And we saw it and we were like, I don't think it is, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, it was a weird moment where we were like, I think we have to like not do this. But we hadn't heard anyone's opinions but our own, and just had to make the best guess we possibly could.
Although I will say that history will bear us out that Taylor Swift should have gotten that Oscar, and her inclusion in our awards issue was us being correct and the Oscars were wrong.
Totally ridiculous.
No, but yeah, you mentioned the blur between film and television, which is something we talked about a lot, I remember, in like the planning meetings for this issue. And it's so fun to see a Hollywood issue with like Michaela Cole and Dan Levy and like, you know, Maya Rudolph, like these people who made such a splash in television this last year, mixing in there. I mean, I love that. That feels like just a real acknowledgement of the reality that we're living in entertainment wise, especially in this year when, you know, so many people, like, we weren't going to the movies. So, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
I gotta say, I can't help imagining I get that if it weren't for a pandemic, we might not have this big, bright and colorful surreal cover, but I can't help imagining the big, bright and colorful party that we would have after the Oscars if we were able to do this in person. Like, my God, I want to go to a theme party based on this cover.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe next year we'll have two parties just to make up
for like an Alice in Wonderland kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
We have cool stuff planned that everyone can take, you know, that'll be obviously online based, but
yes, yeah.
People will be happily surprised.
Yes, there's cool stuff online, but I think the crowded in-person Vanity Fair Oscar party that we might all want to go to right now is going to have to wait a little while.
Yeah.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Well, Jeff, you talked about how what we didn't know about the awards race when we started putting all this together. But the Golden Globes are on Sunday, so it seems like maybe we should take some of that knowledge and maybe predict a little bit about who we think will win. But I think I'm almost more interested in like what this award show will look like and what we want it to look like and what we're going to get from it. So I don't know. What are you guys looking forward to about the Globes one way or another?
I just like to see, honestly, like the voters, like they're on stage and then studio executives come up and give them cash. and then immediately afterward, the voters hand an award over.
No, yeah, I mean, go ahead, Jeff.
Having said that, like, we all read this piece in the LA Times, which is terrific, about what goes on behind the scenes, which is something we all knew it was kind of a clown car, but we didn't quite know how much of a clown car it was at the Hollywood Foreign Press. But, you know, the thing is that the show has been fun over the years. It has been struck a different note. I mean, maybe it's just because they give them alcohol, the stars. But, you know, as much as it's given a lot of crap over the years, which it absolutely deserves. I mean, I think Hollywood is complicit in the sense that they seem to love it. And a lot of people get Golden Globes that are not going to get something else. James Corden is probably not going to receive a ton of honors for his work in Prom. And he's been nominated. So it serves some function that Hollywood needs in its awards thing. But anyhow, I wanted to say that. So fun, I think. I assume it will be goofy fun. What do you guys think?
I mean, as anyone who listens to this podcast knows, I would not strip Rocket Man of any of its honors that it got at the Golden Globes. And I think the Golden Globes existing to drive in that musical comedy lane does make me happy every year. However, I don't think there's a problem with having this like fun, goofy, boozy, you know, televised usually awards ceremony. Like that's fine. I think the problem is like the primacy it's been given in the awards race. You know what I mean? Like we always caveat it. We were like all those wacky, but it doesn't change the fact that it is influential and that when people win a Globe, we talk about it cementing their Oscar choices, or like Mike Hogan was always fond of talking about the Golden Globe speech is almost an audition for what you can promise to like do at the Oscars and stuff like that. So like, you know, it's just such a weird, the Globes are just such a weird phenomenon in that we are constantly kind of knocking it and calling it silly. But then I think it does matter when something like what happened to Minari this year happens, you know what I mean? And so it's complicated.
Yeah, I mean, what do you guys think is going to happen at the Globes in terms of addressing this LA Times article, if anything? Like, are they going to have to, you know, come out and be like, hello, we are a legitimate organization? And how do you do that in a Zoom award show?
I assume the hosts, Faye and Poehler, right, will make it a lot easier. They'll do some funny parody about it, I would think, that would take the sting out of it. And then they can pretend it's not really happening.
Acknowledge it with a joke and then move on and act like you've dealt with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I like them a lot, I have to say. I like seeing them host things, especially after some of the other people that have hosted things. So I'm looking forward to that piece of it. The awkwardness of – we've seen so many Zoomy award shows now or whatever you call it that it you know – and none of them are 100%, so it gets awkward to see what works and what doesn't work. But my hope is as time goes on, like the Oscars will see absolutely everything that bombed before the Oscars come. And the Globes have had a lot of chances to watch the Emmys and everything else to see what'll work.
Richard, what do you think's going to happen?
I don't know. I'm holding out hope that it won't just be like a Zoomy kind of thing, you know? Like, I think something that's interesting about the LA Times piece is that the IGFPA, like, and you know, given that NBC has like pays for the broadcast and everything, like, there are a lot of resources there. It's a very highly watched program still. It's kind of closing the gap with the Oscars. Like, so I hope that they do something to kind of in some way compensate for the fact that we're not going to be watching them at tables getting drunk, you know, all together. So I think it's a kind of test case for, like, you know, for the Emmys, it makes some sense. Like, okay, yeah, it's a TV award show and it's everyone's just kind of beamed in for wherever. But like the movies award shows, like, should, you know, and traditionally feel a little grander. So I'm really curious to see how they kind of make up for that. I mean, the fact that Poehler and Faye are going to be on opposite coast while hosting makes me a little nervous, though.
Because yeah,
that's true.
That sounds very Zoomy, you know.
They should put mics at the table. You know what I mean? Like, if when we go back to being live, I think that that's what you do. You just get the people saying the actual stuff they're saying at the table. That's what I'd like to hear. You cut in and out of them criticizing their best friends.
I think we've run stories in the past where we just like screenshot like the moments between commercial breaks where they're heading in, where you watch everyone getting up and talking to each other and being like, what are they saying to each other?
Yeah.
That's definitely the highlight of it that is just kind of impossible to replicate here.
I remember many years ago, I can't even remember what the group was, but maybe it was like the National Broadcast Critics or something that was for some reason televised, but in the most like almost C-SPAN way at some Hilton ballroom. And it was so drunken and like uncensored. I was like, this is what we want. I don't know how it got on the air, but it was really fun to watch. It was back in the days when like Jack Nicholson would win stuff. And it looked like crap. And obviously, but it was hilarious because they were just more drunk. But I think the fact, like Joanna said, like this is a TV show. And from the beginning, the Golden Globes has always been like, we need stars that will get ratings because the most important thing is the ratings, because then that's how much we get paid. And so that totally, totally affects who they nominate, clearly.
Yeah.
And I think for me, more so even than some of the other things outlined in the LA Times piece, all of which was like expected, but still shocking. I don't know. It was a weird read for me. But the information that there are no black voting members on the HFPA. Like, I probably could have told you that, but to have it sort of written out like that and really helps, you're like, why is HFPA so far behind even the Oscars, which are far behind where our culture should be in this moment? And the answer is, you know, who's voting, you know? So,
yeah. No, it was interesting in that article, too, to hear like anonymous members of the HFPA being like, we need to move forward.
Yeah.
I think that's what I've wondered for a long time is it's 80 people. They get all the perks in the world. Like they probably have very little incentive to change. But knowing that there are people kind of from within it who are going to try to push it, it made me feel maybe for the first time like they might update themselves a little bit the way that the Oscars have.
Yeah, and they've obviously been given money to – they've been doing charity work, as you do when you're doing questionable things behind the scenes. but I'm impressed by that story partly because just finding those voters, let alone the ones who would speak, I don't know how – like do you go to like get your car fixed in Germany and you ask the mechanic if she or he is like a voter, you know, like how do you find out who's voting? That was impressive to me. Because these people, you know.
It's shadowy, right? It's a shadowy organization,
Somebody says in that piece, I don't know how they make a living. And now we have some evidence about how they make a living. But obviously they have all kinds of different jobs that aren't strictly like journalist jobs.
Well, embedded in that kind of thing about the way that the HFPA allegedly kind of supports its members with these kind of make work, you know, payments or whatever, is, I think, not to like exonerate their perhaps corrupt behavior, but like there's a story about the like journalism industry kind of changing and in that like there's this quote that's like interviews with Robert Downey Jr. and Angelina Jolie don't have much value these days. And
it's tragic.
Like, the stuff that they're doing is, you know, because of the internet, I think like the democratization of like content or whatever, like this kind of, well, I'm the foreign correspondent, you know, to Spain, but I live in Hollywood, and here's like I'm sort of the voice of this industry to this publication an ocean away. That doesn't really have the same weight anymore, and so I do feel some, you know, sympathy certainly for people who are like their whole sort of profession has kind of crumbled beneath their feet. That doesn't excuse a lot of the sort of shady practices that are alleged in this story, but like that is a reality of it that I think, you know, is kind of sobering a little bit.
Yeah. Do you guys want to make any predictions about who's going to win or what would be an interesting win from these?
Do you want me to just live record as I write the predictions?
I know. I was like, ask me after I do my homework.
Yeah, I want to hear these.
Well, I'm opening the email draft I'm sending to Hillary Busis with my predictions.
What are things you guys want or you think have a good shot at and you're actually excited about?
Well, so here's the thing that I'm in the middle of writing that I think is an interesting narrative to follow. I think after the Globes and the SAG nominations, the narrative kind of came around that Glenn Close is just going to win for Hillbilly Elegy. Like, it's finally going to happen. And I think we've talked about this on the show, too. And I think a lot of that is borne out by Amanda Seyfried not getting the SAG nomination, pretty surprisingly.
Saying she's going to win the Oscar?
That Glenn Close would win the Oscar for Hillbilly Elegy, And I think if that's going to happen, she's going to win the Globe. Like, that's where this will start. So if Glenn Close doesn't win the Globe, then I think the supporting actress race is wide open again, which is really interesting. So that's one thing I'll be intrigued to look for, but I'm also predicting her to win.
Don't you think that'll be a sad day even for Glenn Close? I mean, before the standard was Al Pacino for Scent of a Woman, like winning an award that was not for the actual thing you were winning the award for, and I feel like Glenn Close will...
I mean, Kate Winslet won for The Reader for kind of no reason other than that it was just time for her to win, and she's done okay. So I don't know.
If
you're Glenn Close, aren't you kind of ready for it to be over? Just to have won the Oscar and have everyone stop being like, oh, poor Glenn, she hasn't won an Oscar.
Yeah, they'll forget what it was for in a few years, and I'll just be Oscar winner Glenn Close.
If you're going to win an Oscar for a bad movie, you may as well make it at the Zoom Oscars.
Okay, what should we do at home to celebrate? As people who take the Golden Globes very seriously, should Ryan Murphy's Ratchet or how many Ryan Murphy wins will it take for us to sort of drain our champagne flute? I don't know. That's my question.
I'm predicting the actor in a comedy or musical and not predicting James Corden to win. But if James Corden does win that, then I think the Ryan Murphy powers have truly exerted themselves.
Who are you predicting?
Sacha Baron Cohen. He would be the first, as far as I could tell, he'd be the first person to win in that category twice as the same character. He not only like, you know, had this what amounts to a hit movie in 2020, but like, you know, helped dethrone Rudy Giuliani. So least we can give him is a Golden Globe.
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't Frances McDormand winning for Nomadland? She played the same character in Three Billboards, right?
See, rough. That's
Richard Lawson speaks for himself and not Condé Nast or subsidiary brands.
Still so salty about Three Billboards.
I'm saltier about it now because she's not going to win a Best Actress Oscar for Nomadland, in which she is incredible.
Won't?
I think the fact that she just won her second Oscar makes that a tough sell, especially because Carey Mulligan, I think, has been really surging with how much people like Promising Young Woman.
I think Carey Mulligan's going to win. Yeah.
Do we think Carey Mulligan's going to win at the Globes too?
Yeah.
It's been interesting to see how much people embrace that movie because it wasn't 100% clear that they would.
I know.
Right?
It felt like a bit of a long shot,
you know, I did not see the narrative coalescing around it the way that it has. I'm curious. Yeah. I'm curious about the Best Picture. You know, like Richard has this great piece about the Best Picture frontrunners and stuff like that. I felt like in the water, we were somehow circling back to Trial of Chicago 7, that's something that was happening. But if Nomadland, you know, once again, here we are. We're talking about like what happening at the Globes affecting the Oscar outcome. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's the importance of the ceremony. But like if a Nomadland narrative coalesces around the Globes, like that feels like it gets pushed into the front runner spot, you know?
It's so amazing that like this small group of foreign correspondents who have absolutely nothing to do with the Oscar voters could yep. affect them. But you're right. It does. It's something in the air. In the yep. air. I don't feel like the Trial of Chicago 7 is a Best Picture movie.
But I don't know if anyone can confidently say like this is going to win Best Picture. Like I don't.
Yeah, that's
I think
right.
I think there's a lot of good arguments for a lot of different, maybe not a lot of different movies, like four or five different movies. But it's really hard to know until some of these awards get handed out, like what is going to rise to the top.
I think it just kind of depends what kind of year is it. Is it a year where we get something like I like Trial Chicago 7 fine. I did. But like is it a year where we're gonna get something like really exciting like Moonlight or Parasite? Or is it a year where we're gonna try to make ourselves feel better about how far we've come a la a Green Book year? And if it's a Green Book year, I think we're doing Trial of Chicago 7. And if it's not, then I think we're doing something a little bit more interesting than what Trial of Chicago 7 has to offer, you know?
Or what if we go in the middle and do Minari? Which is both like new and exciting new voice, but also like a very like encouraging family drama about making it in America.
I would love to see it. I would love it.
I mean, it's not nominated at the Globes for all the reasons we yeah. discussed. So not a question for this Sunday, right. but for further down yeah. the road.
I still like Judas and the Black Messiah best. I know it's not
no, I do
perfect
too.
By any means. If a not perfect movie is going to win, I guess I'm rooting for that. Just because the performances are so fantastic.
I'm completely with you. I think Daniel Kaluuya feels like, which is like so exciting that Daniel Kaluuya is the front runner in his category. That is so exciting to me.
Although given how the Globes didn't nominate Judas in any of the other major categories, I'm wondering if he's going to get beat at the Globes by Leslie Adam Jr., also Sacha Baron Cohen. I don't know. That feels like it could go a little weird.
By the completely non-black voting body at the HFPA, maybe. Who knows?
Who can imagine how that might happen? Jared Leto will win the Golden Globe, and then we'll all have to grapple with it from there.
If this is the ratchet Leto Globes, then it's cursed and just throw it into the ocean. You know what I mean? So.
You can read our Golden Globe predictions. By the time you hear this episode, we'll have written them. And you can read them on VF.com. We'll be covering them, the awards, on Sunday night. And also, next week, we're going to record our episode early and cover the Golden Globes on Monday. So you'll get to hear us react to it in almost real time.
Can I ask one last question, Globes question? I do have a favorite narrative that I like to track every year at the Globes, which is like, who is the fine young thing that the Globes have decided to like anoint with an award? And that's not completely gendered. Sometimes it is a man, but often it is a young woman who the Globes want to be like, look, Carrie Russell, Lena Dunham, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera,
Gina Rodriguez.
Like, we would like to, you know, here's to your bright future. There's a couple options this year. I think Emma Corrin is like up there in the potentials. Anya Taylor-Joy, even though she's been around for a little while, might be up there. But if you guys have any thoughts and feelings about who might be like unofficial Miss Golden Globe of 2021.
Well, it's the TV comedy actress category where that usually happens.
Usually,
and you've got Lily Collins, Kaylee Cuoco, Elle Fanning, and Jane Levy all competing in that lane against Catherine O'Hara, who may very well just win anyway. That's a fun race.
Well,
who's this Kate Hudson?
Who is this?
I mean, music has had an unlikely enough run at this point. She could just walk away with that Golden Globe, and who can say the surprise?
But the Oscars has the same thing, Joanna, right? Like the best actress category for years was just almost seemed like casting.
Sometimes, but it's usually not like for the Globes really likes to do it for like the first season of a new show and a new young actress. Here's, you know,
Claire Danes for My So-Called Life.
Yeah, here's Claire Danes. Yeah. Here's, and they all look so young. Here's Jennifer Garner. She just like popped an alias, something like that. Like someone who's just popped. Versus,
but these are decent choices, right? These are fairly, these are good, right?
Yeah. They like for a long time the Emmys would just never do it, and like, so the Emmys would give it to the same person year after year, and the Globes would be like where you could get recognition as an up and comer. And like now the Emmys seem to have caught up a little bit, but the Globes definitely still like it's likes to have their finger on the pulse more than most other awards bodies.
And they're all going to be dressed up at home. Is that right? Is that what we're hearing?
That's what we're expecting. And like, there's nothing confirmed out there, but it seems that people have learned that even if everyone is miserable at home in sweatpants, that we want to see people dressed up and looking great. Maybe as evidenced by our Hollywood cover. So I'm hoping for some good looks too.
Wait, they just sent a press release out about the New York side of the broadcast.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
Yes.
And all of the presenters are going to be live from New York's famed Rainbow Room. So
interesting.
The Bryce Dallas Howard, Christopher Maloney, Rosie Perez, Christian Slater. I mean, you know.
The who's who's of NBC. Yeah.
New York's hottest nightclub, the Rainbow Room.
No, but like Joaquin Phoenix, Margot Robbie, like, you know, Joaquin Phoenix is going to be in the Rainbow Room on Sunday. So that's.
Or maybe he's on the LA one. Okay, I don't know.
It's just knowing that they'll be in a glamorous room in a city is, it feels good, right? Like it did, like Amy Poehler's gonna be at the actual Beverly Hilton like by herself for all we know. I don't know, it seems like as a TV broadcast they might cobble together the illusion of people all being in the same space, which is the most we can hope for.
Are they gonna have Renee Zellweger and Catherine Zeta-Jones present together and do a number
to do not nowadays? Yeah. What's the name of that song at the end of Chicago?
The hot honey rag. Yeah, I would love to see it.
Oh my God.
But they, I think the stars have got to really show up in force for these things to show that the industry is still there, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, I hope that both the Globes and the Oscars benefit from that and that we benefit as viewers, because you can't, you know, you could, it should be easy to guilt even the biggest superstars into doing something if they don't have to leave their house mostly.
Yeah. And nearly a year since the Imagine video, like they need to be like, you love us. Remember, you do.
Like, I start to get PTSD just around that time, and I don't know why. And then I remember that it's an anniversary.
Should we do?
I mean, there were a lot of bad things going on around then, so it might not just be the Imagine video that's giving you hives.
Should we do an oral history of the Imagine video for its 1 year anniversary?
Wow. Every no one involved in that will want to talk about it and be like, excuse me, I don't know what you're talking about. I had nothing to do with that.
Poor woman. She really was just trying.
She was trying. It's true.
Okay, so we'll be covering the Golden Globes on Sunday night on VF.com. And then next week, we're going to record our episode early. We're going to record on Monday, so we'll do kind of immediate reactions to the Globes. So join us back then. And Jeff, I think you have to run. So thank you for coming to talk to us.
I do. You're all lovely, and it's an honor to work with you.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, before we get to the interview portion of the episode, we wanted to talk about two movies that are out now. So Cherry is not going to be on Apple TV Plus until March, but it's out in theaters this week. Richard talked to Tom Holland last week, recently, sure, on this podcast. Yeah. What is time? Yeah. This is a kind of an epic in every sense of the word, and it's a big departure for him, having become famous as Spider-Man. Richard, I think you liked the movie more than I did, and I was glad you got to talk to Tom Holland about it. But I do think kind of undeniably, if you have liked him as Spider-Man and kind of seen him really pop in these bigger ensemble movies, that it's worth seeing just to kind of know what he can do.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's if you track an actor's career, it is fun to see them do the transition role or whatever, you know. And I asked him about that in our interview, and he actually answered it pretty frankly in terms of like, I talked with my management team about, which is like nice to hear, because I think a lot of times people are like, no, I hadn't thought about my career in those terms. They do, yeah, they do think about their careers in those terms if they're getting to that level. So it's interesting for that factor. It's interesting to see what the Russo brothers do outside of the Marvel world, outside of, you know, comedy, like they did a lot of Community. Like this is like a drama, an epic kind of thing. I think a lot of it's messy. I think a lot of it, mm-hmm, is kind of over-egged and just kind of not as edgy or inventive as maybe the film thinks it is. That said, I do appreciate, you know, this is based on a novel, but kind of a thinly veiled kind of autobiographical novel by a young man who did join the army, did get addicted to heroin and opioids, did end up in prison, and so there was source material. But this is the one, a movie that's really dealing with the financial fallout and the war and the wars in the early 2000s, the opioid crisis, like the really pertinent stuff that we've seen on film in the form of something like Ben Is Back or whatever. But like this, I think, is aimed at the young people, the young men, really, who went through this and are, you know, going through this. And in that regard, I appreciated the effort to like address directly like people, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I don't think it's talking to the Academy in the same way it's talking to, you know, guys who went through similar things.
Yeah, there's something about like a visibility there. Like we see you, like you see the sacrifice you ask people to make when they go to war, and then how kind of thoroughly a lot of those problems can be ignored. Like I think the fact that it's really long makes me wonder like how much that message is going to get through to people who might need to see it the most. But you know, it moves. Like the movie is not dull, I don't think, despite like being a pretty lengthy one. So I like the idea of what you're saying, Richard. That it's just like it's speaking. It might not be for you, and that's okay. Like it might be speaking to someone who needs it more.
Well, I want to talk about a slightly like larger lens question around this, which is like this idea of there was so much ballyhoo around the Russo brothers, Joe and Anthony, after they come off all of their work at Marvel, and they're like, okay, we're calling it a day. We did Endgame. We've done the biggest movie in the world. We're going to start this new production company, and these are all the exciting things we want to do with it. And like, so far, you know, and they're like, we want to take these Marvel stars that we've worked with and put them in these like kind of challenging projects. And I think that's such a worthy idea of like, we don't want to just keep making Marvel movies, or no knock on Marvel movies, obviously, but like we want to do, you know, we want to like be considered, you know, serious filmmakers, and we want to give these Marvel actors like a real challenge and all that sort of stuff like that. And, you know, I don't think these projects have quite landed the way that they wanted to yet, but I am hopeful that eventually like something that they do here will connect. Do you know?
Okay, and then one other movie coming out that we wanted to get into quickly that is available on Hulu at the end of this week is United States versus Billie Holiday. It's directed by Lee Daniels. It stars Andra Day as Billie Holiday. Andra Day has, you know, been a professional musician for a long time. This is kind of her very big acting debut, and it's a really big part to take on because it's about Billie Holiday. You know, she has to sing and embody this very famous musician, but also exploring these like really dark, terrible aspects of her life and the drug addiction that the FBI kind of used as a way to target her. Partly as part of a pretty misguided war on drugs that, you know, we still see the repercussions of that today, and also attacking her for being outspoken about lynching and about the Jim Crow South. It is a big movie. It is a little messy, maybe messier than Cherry, although they're really wildly different movies. I think Andra Day is pretty stunning in it, and I'm really interested to see where she goes from this. I think she's more interesting than the movie itself. Richard, you're reviewing it, so maybe you can give us a preview of where you're headed with that.
Yeah, I think she's good in it. Sings, you know, incredibly well. I think she's a little underserved by the film, the filmmaking. I think similarly about Trevante Rhodes, who should have been a huge movie star after Moonlight.
Yeah.
And has not really become that, which is, you know, indicative of a lot in the industry. So it's I like seeing them together. I think that obviously the music is good and the history is interesting. I did not know anything about this, her tangles with the FBI and whatever. But, you know, this is one of those Lee Daniels movies where you're like, I'm not really sure what the intention is here, like stylistically and narratively. I think it really does not come together it doesn't do justice to the story it's telling or the performances, you know, contained within it.
Yeah. There's an episode of the NPR podcast Throughline that's also called The United States versus Billie Holiday that I listened to a couple months ago before I saw this movie. And I found it a really useful backstory for it because, you know, this character who Garrett Hedlund plays, the FBI agent who is just like almost comic book villain racist. Like apparently the real guy might have been even worse. So credit to them for maybe holding back there. But it just kind of gives you a sense of like why she was such a target. And also the way that the FBI kind of used these famous people with drug addictions as like, you know, examples. And Billie Holiday was basically like persecuted by the American government while suffering a drug addiction, which I think, you know, we have more understanding now about how it's, you know, an illness. Whereas like Judy Garland was also addicted to drugs around the same time and did not receive nearly the same level of treatment. So I think if you see the movie and want to know more of the history there, that's a good place to start. Because I agree, Richard, that the movie can kind of be scattered to a point that it's hard to kind of get a grasp on what we can learn from it and what to take from it.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, so now we're going to end with Joanna's interview with Mads Mikkelsen, the star of Another Round, which you can watch now. It is available to rent wherever you get your movies on demand. Joanna, I love that you talked to Mads Mikkelsen because he's so terrific in this really terrific movie. And I'm excited to hear what you talked about. What did you talk about?
I loved talking to Mads Mikkelsen. You know, they just talked about, they, you know, this film, not to spoil too much of it for you if you have not watched it yet, but it is about a group of friends, teachers, who decide that they're going to do an experiment to see how drinking, specifically day drinking, might affect their happiness in life. And they're trying to do a controlled experiment around it. And Mads just talked to me about their, like, alcohol boot camp that they went to, where basically, like, they weren't drunk on set, but they did like all these rehearsals where they would drink together and sort of tape themselves and see how they behaved on different levels of drunkenness and stuff like that. This film was a genuine sensation in Denmark this year. It opened in theaters at a moment, Mads and I talked about this, at a moment when it felt safe to do so and there was nothing else in theaters and people were dying to go to the theaters. So they just crowded, like it's just a huge film. And there's a lot of joy in it, a lot of joy for life in it, with a lot of like bitter melancholy also, just sort of laced in there in a European way that I think made it a really solid movie for the times. So it's interesting to watch it this award season because it's nominated for the Globe, but obviously it's up against Minari, which is going to be like a tough battle there, I think. But if the Oscars nominate things the way that they should be nominated, Minari is in the Best Picture category. Another Round, I mean, there's some other, you know, there's La Llorona, there's like a couple other things in the international Oscar category this year. But I think that Another Round has a legitimate shot. And, you know, thanks in part to the fact that it has an actor like Mads Mikkelsen who, you know, a lot of Americans know from his work over here. So, but yeah, Mads, yeah, a complete delight. What a joy. And we did talk about Hannibal, I promise. So, and also Harry Potter. So all the things you could possibly want from Mads Mikkelsen.
Let's listen to it.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
It's me who's saying thanks. We just... so happy that somebody wants to talk about our film.
Well, I've heard you describe this character you play over and over again as a man left at the train platform after the train has left the station, and how that's not something you can necessarily relate to as your own approach to life. But then again, you've also said that the part was written for you. So I'm wondering what you think they saw in you for this role.
I don't know. I mean, luckily, as actors, we're not just playing ourselves all this. We're not like, oh yeah, that's exactly me. So one of the things we have to do is to have empathy and identify with other people's situations. Well, he's not staying there the entire film. He does go other places and with a helping hand from alcohol. He goes to a lot of places throughout this film. So maybe that's what Thomas saw, but he also saw something, I guess, in The Hunt, where part of that man who's giving up is brought to life, I guess. And then he evolves throughout this film more than he did in The Hunt, I would say. I think he just likes to work with me, to be frank. And it could have been one of the other parts, but he gave me this one, and I'm really, really pleased he did that.
They mentioned the film a couple times about this idea of the Danish culture of drinking, how the Danish approach to drinking I think they said drink like maniacs. At least that's the translation I got in my subtitle. You know, having spent a good deal of time in America, what do you think the difference is between our approach to alcohol and the Danish approach?
Depends, I guess, if, where you go. America is a big country. There are so many different cultures within America, right?
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting thing about this film is that, yes, on the surface, it might be a Danish topic to a degree, but every culture has their own history with alcohol, one way or the other. And it's quite recognizable. Yes, they might not have that specific celebration when you're young, when you're just graduating, but they'll have something else. So, and what also is recognizable for other cultures is, this is a tribute to life. This is a life-embracing film. And the alcohol is just a kickstarter for that story. And that's why I think a lot of other cultures can relate to. But to answer your question is that, yes, Americans might go, but are you crazy? Are the teachers just letting the young kids do that? You know, and they will have a standard for that. But then at the same time, they will drive their big cars to a business meeting at lunch, and they will down a bottle of wine, and they will go back in their car and drive home. So they have a different standard with that. So I think that standards are different, but alcohol is here, has been here for 6,000 or 7,000 years, and we've always used it for the same purposes, either to forget our miserable lives or to get closer to the gods or be creative or just lift the conversation into something more relaxed and beautiful. And then obviously now we're talking about two glasses of wine, but if we talk about two bottles, it's a completely different story, but every nation knows that story as well.
Something, you know, I think this is a really relatable, really human story, but something that feels very especially un-American about it is that it's a story without a hard moral lesson. You're not trying to come down on one side or another. And I feel like that's nearly impossible to do in American film. We don't make those in the middle movies, do you know?
Yeah, you used to. I mean, my biggest inspiration ever, an eye-opener for me when I was a young man, I thought I was going in to watch one of the stories where you have a baddie and a goodie and then a lot of action and film. I saw the poster, I saw some photos, and it looked really messy and bloody, and it was called Taxi Driver, and I went in to see it, and it just blew my mind that you could, you know, you could like a character and then you could hate him, and then you could like him, and then you could hate him. You were just being thrown around by the actor and the director. And I left the movie theater with a lot of questions and a lot of curiosity, but no answers. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant that film could do that. So you have a tradition for it. It somewhere down the line here, it's gotten a little blurry. We do want to point finger at certain things. But in Thomas's world, that was never the goal. There has been a lot of films that warns us about the danger of alcohol, and there's been a lot of beautiful films about that. He wanted it to be a kind of a tribute to all the things that we like about alcohol, just not just you and me, but everybody. Why do we, it's a social lubricant, you know. Why do we love those two first glasses of wine and that fantastic conversation with friends? How many have met their spouses without having alcohol involved? So it's there. And that's what he wanted to research into, right? And then it was unavoidable that we will also have to dig a couple of big holes, because that's where alcohol can take you. So that was part of the film, but we didn't want to make it the biggest part.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to me. The character has been described both by you and Thomas as sort of this character, your character specifically, is one sort of in the middle. You don't know whether he wants to fly or drown. You don't know which way he's going to go or any of them are going to go in this experiment. And that's such an interesting, right on the edge thing to play. How do you approach something like that?
Well, I think he's in a situation at the end of the film where he's just lost someone he loved, and then he might just have gained someone he loved as well within the same hour. And that dual emotional situation is what we wanted the last scene to be about. There is a dance, but it's not about the dance. It's the inner journey of the dance. That's how he feels in this moment. And the lyrics of the song is just ironically and pure coincidence are very, very, very spot on to the film's final scene. And I didn't notice until I saw the film the second time that, you know, he just wants to forget and be happy just for 5 minutes, you know, and that's what the song is about. And feel young again, which is an important theme in these guys' lives, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's the situation he's in. We never wanted it to be a solid, closed ending like, oh, done, over my time as a desperate middle-aged man, I'm over and I will go home now. Oh, yeah. And we didn't want it to be, you know what? I don't want to go home. I just want to stay here and celebrate. We didn't want that either. We wanted it to be the moment. And if you ask me and Thomas, he does fly. He doesn't drown. Mm-hmm. But other people would see it differently, and that's fair enough.
Yeah. You said already a couple of times to me this idea of sort of male middle-aged desperation. Oftentimes these stories are about men in this midlife crisis space. Do you think it's a distinctly male condition or male story?
No. I see that in women as well. I see this film easily. And I would suggest that if anyone does a review of it, I would suggest. I'm not always a fan of just swapping genders in a film because for the sake of doing it. But I think you can easily do it in this film, and it would be very interesting to see that as well. And I think that we get some other facets, but I think that the core of the story would be the same. Lots of women will find themselves in a situation where they look at their past as something they're not completely satisfied with. And they look at the future as something that they're a little jealous on. And they forget to live in here and now, in the present. And that's definitely the situation my character is in. And he has to reinvent and rediscover why he loves his job. And he has to realize that I do love my family. Why am I complaining? What's wrong with me? Why can't I find happiness in life again? You know, I don't think it's a typical male situation. I don't think so. But you would know better than me. But you're not middle-aged. You're not middle-aged yet, so you don't know.
Soon. I'm wondering, do you think it's intentional then to make these men teachers and to make them constantly around younger people and being reminded?
Yes.
Absolutely.
There was a reason in the beginning. I had a job in a control tower in an airport, which was obviously a funny idea. If you start drinking just a little. Mm-hmm. But then he wanted the friendship to be closer. He wanted them. He had a better opportunity if we were working in the same place to see interaction between us. Mm-hmm. And yes, obviously, the mirror image of the kids, the immortals, the ones that has an enormous future. Death is not an option. And a crisis is not an option. It's just immortality right in front of you. Every single day you see it. And you realize that you're not there anymore yourself. So that's definitely not a coincidence that it became a school.
I'm curious, this is a huge hit in Denmark. What have you seen from those American audiences who have been able to see it so far? What is the response been? Have you been surprised at all by any reactions?
Not super surprised, because we saw it a little in other countries where we, as you hinted to, like we had a fear that it was too Danish. But then we've seen it, you know, the embracement of celebration of life in general. I always call it his most Italian film, because it doesn't matter how dark an Italian film is. We exit the movie theater with a big love of life. And I think that's what he's doing with this film. So we saw that happening around Europe. And luckily, that's the same reaction we've had in America. So it seems as if if you make films about love and life and friendships, it's universal. And then if you add some alcohol, everybody can relate to it in one way or the other.
I'm curious, as I said, this is a smash hit in Denmark in a year of a pandemic, in a year where a lot of the world was not going to the movies. But, you know, Denmark had for at least a time a better control on the virus than some other countries. So you weren't as locked down as some other countries. But I'm wondering what it's like to have a big
what it feels like to have a big film hit in a pandemic year.
That was a surprise to us. We were, obviously everybody was afraid in that period. Thought we had, movie theaters were open, but they had a 50% capacity, which is a huge thing, right? Because normally you come out with a film, you have to make, sell all your tickets the first month, and then something else comes up. But there was nothing else. Nobody came out with that film, so we were all alone. And it just grew and grew and grew. And we had hoped for something like that, but not as much. This was explosive. And then what we talked about before, I don't think anyone in their right mind wanted to sit down in the movie theater and watch a film about the COVID-19 situation. They were just so pleased to see a film about what life was used to be just half a year ago. And they've been craving it. So I think that combo of us being alone on the platform and a film that people have been craving, that was making the difference.
Do you know why no one else released? Was it just fear of not being able to make the money back in theaters?
Yeah.
Or
everybody, yeah. At that point, we didn't know whether we were going to shut down in a week, because it was always on, you know, an edge. It's like, okay, let's give it another week without any shutdowns, but we might have to make some radical choices soon. So everybody was fearing that could be one of the choices, right? It happened to a second film I did right after, that came out right after we finished in the movie theater, and it was a massive success as well, but then it was shut down. So so that was just when it was just about to peak. So that was, we were fearing that for another round as well.
Something that Thomas has said, you know, this film includes a lot of hallmarks of his work: handheld camera, some improvisation. How do you think those approaches lend themselves to this story specifically that you're trying to tell?
I think that would have been impossible to do without these things. At least it would have been a very different film. I am a very big fan of handheld camera. I'm not a fan of the shakiness of it, unless there's a very good purpose for it. But I love the dance between the camera man and the actress, that he will find you one way or the other. If it's interesting enough, somehow he will find you. So it becomes, for me, it becomes a very fluid way of filming. We could have done it with, you know, put up some tracks and wait for 2 hours for those tracks to be balanced. And then, but we're in the mode and we need to go now. And then we can shoot in a more efficient way and capture the moment a little better. I don't say that all films should be made with handheld, but this one I don't think we could have done as precise. Thomas also uses the handheld in a slightly different way than he's done before, because when we are not drinking, especially in the beginning of the film, it's a little offbeat, the camera moves. Mm. It's a little, something is not right. And the second we start drinking, the camera becomes super fluid. So that was a thumbs up to drinking as well, a little comment.
You've talked a lot about this sort of drinking boot camp that you all went through
talk a lot about it. People ask a lot.
Okay, people ask about it then. Yeah. I find that idea interesting. And I'm wondering if you could go, I don't know how much you can share about it, but what is a drinking boot camp look like?
It was very specific. We didn't go on a drinking boot camp to figure out how is it to be drunk, because between the four of us and director, I think we have more than enough experience about that. So it was more to be as specific as these guys are in the film. Well, 005, 008.
Right.
And we filmed that, and we did a couple of scenes and tried them out. And then when you're in the midst of a situation like that, that's the interesting thing about alcohol, is that if everybody else is drinking as well, you think this is normal now. This is just normal. And you don't really feel a difference. It's not really a difference. But when you see the next day on a video, on a screen, you're like, there is a difference. And they're a very interesting difference. And there was a big difference between 005 and 008. Because you could easily hide it to a degree. You might just be a little more happy today when you're at 005. But then 008, something happens. Maybe you move your hands a little different. Maybe that you get a little sloppy with your hands, or your speech, you start lisping on certain words, you know. And then, of course, when you go further than that, across that limit, then you don't care if people see if you're drunk anymore. Then nothing matters, right? So it's quite interesting to get inspired by these levels, so we can go up and down in the volume when we were doing specifically the teaching scenes. for the insane crazy drunk scenes, we just watched a lot of YouTube video where people were drunk for real, and then we figured out how to approach that.
Was that rehearsal process, was it deeply regimented? Were you blowing in a breathalyzer to make sure you had 0.05? Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah,
yeah. And it's interesting that we react differently on different levels for body size or for other reasons as well. But the beauty of the whole thing is that you think one thing of yourself when you are drinking, and that is not coming across.
Like how smooth and charming you are, and then you go, oh no.
Yeah. Well, most people are kind of smooth and charming after a couple of glasses, but they also think they are after two bottles. Sure. And that is not the case.
Are you, you're currently right now shooting one of the Fantastic Beasts films. Is that correct? And so is this the first project you've done with COVID restrictions sort of in place?
Yeah.
Has that been at all restrictive to your creative process? How does it impact you creatively?
It's a tricky question because we are wearing our masks and we take them off when we start acting and then we put them back on the set and they say cut. That can be a little annoying, especially for makeup department that has to constantly come and fiddle. If you're wearing rouge or lipsticks or whatever you are. But that's okay. That's doable. It's more the social things between when you're talking with people, when you're talking about the scene or maybe something you're going to do tomorrow that you literally cannot see people's expression. And I've not gotten used to it, and I will never get used to it. And so I think it's a big part of our communication tool that's taking away from us when we block this entire area.
Yeah.
But at least we can work. And so I'm not going to sit here and cry. There are tons of people and tons of small businesses that is just suffering in a completely different manner than we are.
And I'm interested, you know, in this project, obviously there's a lot of extra story around you taking over the character of Grindelwald, but I'm most curious what it is about that character that's interesting to you, that was interesting for you to take on.
I think the universe, first and foremost, is very interesting. It's on the cool meter. It's pretty cool for my kids, even though they might be not Harry Potter people anymore. They still love the franchise. And so that's cool. Uh-huh. And this is like an adult version where I think they're very, very touching, the love stories and the interaction between some of the characters in these stories. And then I think there was an interesting background for my character that we are exploiting a little more in this third film. But it's always interesting, you know, to play someone who in other people's eyes are doing terrible, terrible things. But in his eyes and his followers' eyes, he's doing a necessary thing and in the long run, a very beautiful thing. So that is obviously the conflicts you can find everywhere in the world. Very few people come out and say, I am evil and that's what I want to be.
Right.
<You
know? laughs> Right.
They definitely believe that this will make the world a better place, you know. So this is always interesting to have that dilemma.
And there are two other, you know, there are two actors who played this role before, Johnny and Colin. You've talked about wanting to sort of make this a continuum of those performances. That seems to me to be something I don't think you've done before necessarily. And sort of
never.
Creatively, what does that look like for you?
These are hard choices, of course, because they've both put their marks on what they did. And we just need to make some bridges that people are aware of with what character it is now. You know, it has to be a bridge somehow. When that is said, there's no way I can copy what Johnny did. He has a very specific way of doing his thing. And I think he's such a wonderful actor, and it would be creative suicide to go down that path. So I have to find it myself. Yeah. And we can just hope that people would embrace that we're changing the course a little, but we are also building a bridge as much as we think we could.
And lastly, my friends who are Fannibals would crucify me if I didn't ask you about Hannibal. Yeah. So, of course, I have to because you know how intensive the Fannibals are.
They are. We love them.
What do you think of the ability of fan movements, like, say, bringing Zack Snyder's Justice League back from the dead or whatever it is, in this era of filmmaking, that fans have such an impact or a voice or a platform to push for the things that they love?
I think they have a very big impact. I think that, and as long as it's used in what I consider a positive manner, like, you know, oh, please, can we have this again? I think that the positive things can come out of that. And I have a hunch that we would not have had a third season if it was not for the Fandibles. So I think they're powerful. A little warning, the fans should be careful with screaming cancel constantly at other things that they don't want. Use it positive. If there's something you feel should be canceled, start out by not watching it. And then other people decide if they want to watch it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for the conversation and for this lovely movie. I really loved it. So thank you.
Oh, thanks a lot. Really, really happy when you say that. Thanks.
That does it for this week's episode. As I said, next week we're going to have a special Monday episode about the Golden Globes. So check your podcast feeds early. Join us to talk it all over. And in the meantime, you can tweet at us at Little Gold Men. And don't forget, you can text us. You can go to joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen to sign up, or just text us at 718-550-2059. And if you're confused and you remember me listing a different number, they give us a bunch of different numbers you can text. So a wide variety of options. But we love hearing from you guys there, so please keep it up. You can find us on VF.com. You can find the entire Hollywood issue. Please feast your eyes on Twitter at Little Gold Men, as I said, and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich, and Richard.
Rylaws.
And Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for how the VF top brass reacted when they finally listened to this podcast goes to Jeff Giles.
We all knew it was kind of a clown car, but we didn't quite know how much of a clown car it was.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.